to be American.
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Donald Trump's second presidency has been unprecedented in many ways. Some people have suggested that his actions in expanding the executive branch and in using executive orders to target his political opponents have threatened democracy in a manner that America has never seen. The very fact that he was reelected after what happened at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, and that he pardoned the participants of the insurrection, suggests that perhaps America is at a crossroads regarding what it even means to live in a democracy. But how unprecedented is Trump's presidency? Are there historical examples to draw from? And how do we, the people, ensure that democracy thrives for another 200 years and beyond? Here to help place Trump's presidency in historical context is Corey Brettschneider. Corey is a professor of political science at Brown University, teaching law and political theory. He's the author of multiple books, most recently The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy, and The Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. He's also the co-host of a new podcast, The Oath and the Office. Corey, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks so much, Josh. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, great to have a chance to speak with you again to kind of put what's going on in 2025 in historical context. I've heard from lots of people, I'm sure you have as well, that we're living in such an unprecedented time. But your book suggests that there are at least five prior presidents who attacked democracy in various different ways. So I guess just give us a summary. Who are the five you're discussing? And, you know, briefly, what did they do to attack democracy?
Great. And exactly as you say, I certainly wouldn't want to minimize the threat to democracy that we're facing now. And some of what Trump is doing, I think, actually is unprecedented. We could get into that. But as you say, he's not the first president to threaten democracy in a very serious way by any means. And part of what I want to argue is that these five don't just randomly occur, that there's a warning at the founding by Patrick Henry, the revolutionary hero. Patrick Henry sees that the danger comes from the presidency itself, because if you have a criminal president, the supposed checks on office, the Congress, impeachment, the courts, he says they're not going to work, that there'll be nothing, in his words, to stop this force. And even, he says, the president might make, and this is his quote, one bold push for the American throne. So I argue that warning, although it hasn't come to life in the sense that we have actually destroyed democracy, it's survived, it hasn't been the traditional checks and balances. It's been citizens pushing back against presidents who threatened it. So to answer your question, the five are Adams with the Sedition Act and the attempt to, I argue, shut down the opposition party, something that goes way beyond the way it's usually understood, 126 prosecutions of political opponents. And it's the story, too, at the same time, of the newspaper editors who fought back and eventually won. James Buchanan, who lobbies the Supreme Court to decide the Dred Scott case in the worst possible way, in my opinion, the most evil of all decisions in American history, and there have been some bad ones, pushing the court to say that Black Americans have no rights under the Constitution. And there it's the story of Frederick Douglass leading a wing of abolition to recover a democratic idea of the Constitution. The third, Andrew Johnson, to try to bring slavery back under a different name, a kind of second-class citizenship. And still the Douglass story looms large there. I argue he really is a unique founder of America in the 19th century, as opposed to our 18th century founders pushing back against Johnson as well. Woodrow Wilson isn't the first racist president, but he is the first white nationalist president. That's my argument, spreading the ideas of white supremacy culturally and through his executive orders. And it's the story of the early civil rights movement pushing back against that assault. And the fifth is a little different. Richard Nixon, who you might assume would be part of the story, certainly is, for his general philosophy, I argue, of placing presidents above the law. But that one's a little different than the others in that I argue we have not yet recovered from the Nixon presidency. And in many ways, the crisis of now is one that emerges from the Nixon era.
So let's talk a little bit about the crisis of now. How does Trump compare in historical context with these five presidents? I mean, of course, he's actually pointed to Andrew Johnson as a hero, right? So it's interesting that Johnson's on the list. Would Trump be on the list? And what specific things is he doing that compares to those prior presidents?
Absolutely, he's on the list. Even he was during the first term, and now in his second term, he's doubling down on the assault of democracy. The book begins by giving a description of a president who threatens to shut down his political opponents, who promises to spread white supremacy and declares himself above the law. And the point is, it sounds like I'm describing Trump, which I am, but I'm also describing these five. And what is kind of unique about Trump, I would say, is that he really combines the threats to democracy that you see in each of them. So, for instance, in the Adams case, his party really partakes in a January 6th-like attempt to usurp the Electoral College and shuts down the editor, William Duane, who reveals that plot. And you see, of course, in his attack on civil rights, using actually the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which I talk about at length in the book, to really undo civil rights, he is taking a playbook from people like Wilson and Johnson. And of course, in his criminality, he resembles Richard Nixon, and in his philosophy, really, of a president being above the law. As he says, the book begins with George Washington's second inaugural, a president the shortest ever given. But he says, look, I just took the oath of office. It requires me to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And if I violate it, I want the people assembled here to upbraid me or even subject me to constitutional punishment. That idea of the office is the opposite, not just of these five, but especially of Donald Trump, who claims instead, I have an Article II, it says I can do anything I want, and who also denied that he has an obligation to uphold the Constitution.
So in the five presidential examples you gave that you talk about in this book, you know, you say there's an anti-democratic president, but then a new political figure emerges that comes after, often offers a contrast or a recovery for democracy. So Lincoln came after Buchanan, Carter followed in the election after Nixon resigned. But Trump lost 2020 and yet won in 2024. So does Trump's resurgence change the narrative or complicate the story here?
Absolutely. I mean, exactly as you say, part of what's reassuring about the book, and of course it was finished before Trump won re-election, is that in the past, it's not just that citizens fought back, it's that they won. And they won by prevailing on what I call recovery presidents. And my hope certainly was when Trump was defeated by Joe Biden, that Joe Biden would be a recovery president and that we would restore many of the lost parts of the office that Trump had assaulted. But not only did that not happen, but Trump actually has come back. And so I said in a piece through the New York Times when the book came out, that that's part of what is unique about the danger, that in the past, Adams leaves office and doesn't return after his defeat, and the Sedition Act is allowed to expire. Andrew Johnson doesn't even get the nomination of his own party. Woodrow Wilson, of course, dies and is not able to come back in any way into political life. And Nixon resigns, and although he's a statesman and around, there's no threat of a political comeback. But Trump's reemergence and his constituency, I talk about Douglas and the newspaper editors galvanizing Democratic constitutional constituencies. Trumpism has galvanized an anti-democratic constitutional constituency in favor of an authoritarian idea of the presidency. And that really is frightening. And that's why, although the book gives hope in that we've recovered before, it's not a guarantee that we will in the future. And certainly at this moment, it's far from obvious what's going to happen.
To what extent do you think the Supreme Court's decision last summer on presidential immunity has emboldened Trump in a new way that maybe these five presidents didn't feel even as emboldened or strong? The fact that he got immunity, or at least the court said there's different categories for his conduct and he's immune from prosecution for some and maybe not others. How has that contributed to the second Trump presidency?
Part of the thesis of the book is that it's not just that these presidents threaten democracy. You might think, what about the Supreme Court? Shouldn't they come in, for instance, and strike down a Sedition Act? That's clearly unconstitutional. Well, that's not how the court saw it, and it's not how the court has seen it in many of these moments. And in fact, the crises are usually made worse, or at least not fixed, by the Supreme Court. So in the case of the Sedition Act, Samuel Chase not only argues for the Sedition Act, he sits on the trial of Thomas Cooper, one of the editors who's prosecuted. And as Cooper tries to raise the issue of free speech at the trial level, Chase won't even allow it. Now, Cooper prevails eventually by going beyond the court to the American people, turning the election into a referendum on the right to free speech. And so you have this current always of the authoritarian constitution and the pushback, not by courts, but by citizens. And we're seeing that here, too. The immunity decision really compounds the danger of a criminal president who declares himself above the law. And although, as you say, there is a kind of subtlety to the opinion, it's an immunity for official acts, it's presumptive, and there is room to maneuver around it. It has given Trump cover, no doubt, in the January 6th case, in the other cases against him, from prosecution. And so rather than holding him to the law, seeing him prosecuted as any other citizen, he's escaped it. It also helps me to make my point about Nixon, because usually in constitutional law, what about U.S. versus Nixon, 8-0, saying a president's not above the law. Well, what the immunity decision makes clear is that's not the meaning of U.S. versus Nixon. That's a case about why a sitting president can be subpoenaed in a criminal case in which he's a co-conspirator. People like Kavanaugh, for instance, Justice Kavanaugh have narrowed it in that way. And the immunity decision just makes clear that that broad slogan of a president is not above the law, no person is above the law, that's really not the meaning of the Nixon era. We left unsolved the question of prosecution of not just sitting presidents, but what's so unbelievable about this decision, why I believe it's a lawless decision, is it creates an immunity for former presidents as well. And while there is a long tradition, Adams among them, of saying sitting presidents have immunity, I think that part is new and a unique kind of danger.
Isn't it a potential response to this whole conversation that you just don't like the politics of Donald Trump? Where's the line between calling a president anti-democratic and seeming to be partisan in the way that we evaluate the current small d democratic system?
Well, I don't think it's just partisan, and we have to start to think about what the fundamentals of democracy are that go beyond. Now, certainly there are things that he's doing that are the stuff of normal partisan politics. For instance, his economic policy. And Donald Trump has brought about a kind of controversial economic populism. But that's not really what I'm talking about. What I outline from the beginning are three core values of constitutional democracy. The idea that you have a right not just to free speech, but a right to dissent, to criticize the president. That might seem obvious. We have Saturday Night Live every week, after all, mocking the president. But at the time of the founding, it was far from obvious. Adams and his party and the court actually just believed that the right to free speech meant you couldn't have prior restraint, licensing requirements, for instance, for newspapers, but that punishing somebody for their speech, even imprisoning them, and if it was the president, that was fine. And even the law was so bold as to make it a crime to criticize the president, but it left it as perfectly legal to criticize the vice president. Of course, the vice president was a member of a different party, Thomas Jefferson. So that's not any kind of attack on democracy. It's an attack on the very idea, as Alexander Micheljohn said, as important as voting, to hear criticism of our leaders, to criticize or to evaluate them. That's the meaning of democracy. And I'd say the same about civil rights and equal protection, that a democracy isn't really a democracy if it denies fundamental rights to racial minorities. And of course, that's what we did in this country before we recovered an ideal of we the people, as Frederick Douglass said, not just we the white people. And the notion, too, of impunity, that you could create an office in which not only was the oath disregarded, but our basic criminal laws were disregarded, the rule of law, as John Adams actually interestingly often spoke about it. So when you think of those three pillars of democracy as fundamental, people could argue with me, but that doesn't sound partisan. And then you hold them up, not against just these five presidents, but also against Donald Trump. There is a real failure here. And that's why in 2016, when he was making a lot of his proposals that he's brought about, I wrote a piece called Trump versus the Constitution to try to make the point in Politico in 2016 that this isn't just an assault on one party's values. values or a new kind of politics. It's an assault on constitutional democracy itself and an assault on the oath. And that's why my podcast, as you mentioned, is called The Oath and the Office. A President Pledges to Preserve, Protect, and Defend the Constitution. And that's, as I defend it, a democratic idea of a constitution with these various values embedded. And Donald Trump has a very different idea of the office.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Trump has even said that he's not sure if he needs to uphold the Constitution or if due process applies to everyone. Your book discusses, as we've been talking about, the five anti-democratic presidents in history you identify, but it also highlights everyday Americans who pushed back. You discuss Frederick Douglass, you discuss Ida B. Wells, Daniel Ellsberg. I think one of the points here is that we need not just rely on institutions, but it's about the people. So who are the people today who are those everyday Americans that can provide a response to the current issues we have with democracy?
Part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to inspire that response. And, you know, I considered giving a list of names, and people are always asking me for that. But part of the purpose of writing a book of history, I think, is to inspire without giving a prescription of who these people are going to be. I can tell you what the issues are. The issues are recovering this idea of a fundamental right to dissent, of an idea of equal protection and civil rights, apart from the really inversion of those concepts that you're seeing from this Trump administration. And for instance, their assault on universities, the assault on free speech, and the shutdown of law firms that represent people that this administration disagrees with. Of course, that going back to that immunity discussion, the idea of a rule of law. Now, who's going to do that work? We can just start to watch and see. And there are various organizations. The ACLU and its litigation, for instance, has traditionally been among those people pushing back, or the NAACP. But I didn't want to give a prescription or a list because they're going to emerge. One thing about Frederick Douglass is the last thing in the world people would have thought when he was recently escaped, formerly enslaved person, is that this person is going to become the most famous defender of not just anti-slavery, but articulating, as I said, a democratic idea of the Constitution. That just isn't something that you would have imagined. And that's what I think will happen over the next couple of years, next even year, that leaders will emerge. Who the people are, and Josh, you can help me identify them. And with guests on my podcast, The Oath and the Office, and on your show, I'm sure we'll find them.
Yeah. And it is true that, you know, the people I speak with, so many have really inspiring stories of the work they're doing just at the local level. And I often tell people that perhaps the biggest impact you can have is not trying to change national discourse, but in your own local community, that's where you can see the actual effects. So given all of this, you know, you've written a book about anti-democratic presidents. We've talked about how the current president fits the mold you've identified to be in that same category. Are you optimistic about elections, about democracy? How do we stay optimistic?
I want to be optimistic. I'm a little leery of that way of putting it, because the reason I use the term hopeful is because certainly there's a more than a chance of recovering, that there's a past pattern of doing so. And I believe I'm an optimist by nature. I believe that we can do so. But I in some ways also have to check myself, because although I think ultimately Patrick Henry was proved wrong, that although the traditional checks, the court impeachment, for instance, has never actually removed a president, although Nixon was, under threat of impeachment removal, forced to resign. So it's not the traditional checks that have worked, but this other mechanism of citizens pushing back, reclaiming a democratic constitution by prevailing on recovery presidents, that actually is a pattern in American history. It's not guaranteed. And so when we talked about the fact that Trump has reemerged and a lot of the challenges, the assault on all really the features of democracy that we've been talking about, this time it might be destroyed. And I've been talking about this as an attempted self-coup, and that's a term that political scientists who study Latin America and other countries that model themselves on the presidential system use to describe not a coup that's violent, but an attempt to really destroy the other branches from the inside, including the courts and the Congress. And that is what we're in the midst of, an attempted self-coup. And I don't want to say that that's the end. It hasn't succeeded yet, and I don't believe it will. So maybe in that sense, I'm not just hopeful, but an optimist. And I'd also point out that if you were in 1798 and looking at the variety of laws passed by that Congress, including the Sedition Act, shutting down the free speech rights of citizens. I should mention, too, one of the laws that we're talking a lot about, the Alien Enemies Act, is also from 1798 and should be understood in the context of this wider assault on democracy. The Enemy Aliens Act is being used to deport green card holders and non-citizens to a prison in El Salvador. Many, I think, rightly have called it a kind of gulag to illustrate its lawlessness. The law that's being used is the 1798 law. So I say all this to say things look very bleak at the time that law was passed, 1798 or after Dred Scott. I don't want to underplay that. It's a frightening time for democracy, but we've prevailed before, and I believe we'll prevail again.
Corey Brettschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University and the author of The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. He's also the co-host of the podcast, The Oath and the Office. Corey, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
What a pleasure. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Corey Brettschneider was a little cautious about feeling optimistic about the future of democracy in this country. So I'm going to turn the tables here, if I may, Josh, and ask you, how is your optimism about voting in elections holding up these days?
It's still strong because, you know, I get this question all the time. Well, are we going to have a 2026 congressional election? Are we going to have a 2028 presidential election? The answer is yes. The question to me is, to what extent are those elections going to be free and fair? And it will require institutions like the courts. And again, we're starting to see the courts really push back against some of these anti-democracy measures. It's going to take the people. And we're starting to see, you know, through town halls throughout the country, the people, whether it's Republican members of Congress or Democratic members of Congress, seeing real pushback from the people. So I still have faith in this idea of democracy, but it's not going to allow us to be sitting back on our heels. As the old saying goes, democracy is not a spectator sport, and that is so true today, if any time it's been true.
Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host. Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm the series producer, and Neil Kesterson is technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond, research assistant. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU. Educate myself on the fight.